Gata on opening the sutra.
The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
Good morning. I wrote this talk shortly after seeing a little snippet of the PBS show on the Buddha that ran, what was it, about 3 weeks ago. And it come home from the Zendo and I was kind of tired and I just kind of flipped it on for a few minutes. And I just watched for a few minutes. And basically my reaction was, oh God, please don't say this to Americans about Buddhism. And so that's where this talk kind of came out of. You know, because, I mean, at least the piece I watched, the monk who was being interviewed outlined the path of Buddhism using three terms: mindfulness, equanimity, and enlightenment. Now, if you've been here at Treetop for a while, you may recognize the fact that we rarely, if ever, use those terms to describe our practice. And that might seem curious to you, because certainly there are a number of prominent teachers and lineages which do speak in these terms, to the extent that these have really become a major part of the popular conceptualization of Buddhism in this country. So I thought it might, hence the genesis of this talk, to kind of look at both the terms and what they might mean and why they might not be a regular part of our treetop lexicon. So as the monk described it, mindfulness is the key to attaining equanimity, and when a certain level of equanimity is reached, enlightenment occurs. That's actually how he did explain it. And so therefore, in this view, mindfulness is the foundation of the path. So what does mindfulness mean? Quite simply, it means paying attention. Paying attention to what? To whatever is before us, to this moment, to this very reality. When we are counting breaths, we should be mindful of breathing. When we are doing kinhin, we are mindful of walking, and so on. Of course, even those of you who haven't been doing this very long have probably discovered that it's not easy, as our thoughts arise endlessly, and we quickly become distracted. Being mindful is not the habitual way we respond to the activity of our minds. So in order to change the habit, we need to recognize that we've drifted off, let go of whatever distraction is holding us, and resume counting our breath at one. That is the process: becoming aware that we are no longer paying attention, letting go of our thoughts or other distractions, and returning to the breath. So this may be one reason that we don't often speak of mindfulness, because in our Zen practice, we place the emphasis on the act of letting go. We talk about the path of Zen as a lifetime of letting go of everything, of our ideas, of our attachments, of our delusions, of our cabins. And over time, as we practice, we gradually move from the firmament of certainty formed by the static conceptualizations that form our views of self and other, gradually awakening to the vibrant and dynamic reality whose constant flux and uncertainty has always been right before our eyes. Thus, I think that in Zen, we see mindfulness as an important tool in the process of letting go, and nothing more. This brings me to the second reason we may not speak a great deal about mindfulness: that in some places it appears to have been elevated to an almost sanctified status, where it is seen as an especially worthy activity and state of mind, an end in itself. From a Zen perspective, we might suggest that to speak of mindful and unmindful states is to create a distinction, a preference, a hierarchy. We might argue that all that we do is to repeatedly become aware, then we let go, and we return to the original object of our awareness, and nothing special has happened, and no sanctified state of mind has been achieved. Furthermore, we might wonder if mindfulness as an end in itself doesn't imply that there must continually be an observing consciousness and an object of that consciousness. In order for body and mind to fall away, ending the distinctions that obscure the great reality, the one body, mindfulness itself must be forgotten, or it too will be a hindrance to our practice. Now someone might ask, perhaps Kyle, if mindfulness is nothing special, why is right mindfulness one of the components of the Buddha's core teaching of the Eightfold Noble Path? Which is a very good question. My understanding is that right mindfulness implies much more than paying attention. It implies taking responsibility for how we think and for the consequences of our actions. It opens the possibility of freedom because it opens the moment in which we can let go of our automated responses and respond naturally and compassionately to whatever is before us. In essence, right mindfulness is the possibility of letting go and starting again, fresh, aware, and responsible. Now we come to equanimity. To me, equanimity implies a state of mind that is undisturbed by the waves of emotion that rush through us as we encounter the ups and downs of our lives. We could presume that a person with equanimity would not respond angrily to all of the petty insults and injuries that we encounter in each day of our lives, for example. However, I'm not sure that true equanimity exists, or at least exists as a possibility for most of us. Just like our thoughts, our emotions are a natural part of our being, and I doubt that we can be so unattached that we can move through life without these responses, just as we cannot extinguish our thoughts. Once again, from a Zen perspective, we speak about letting go of our emotions and their associated thoughts. Emotions are inevitable, but we don't need to feed and sustain them. If someone cuts me off on the highway, I can see my anger arise instantaneously, but I don't have to carry it. I can recognize it for what it is and return to my drive in the beautiful spring day. Or I can go on about what a jerk that guy is. Perhaps I can reflect on how many bad drivers there are these days. To that I can add that our society is clearly deteriorating. Pine a while for the good old days, and mourn the inevitable and rapidly approaching destruction of our world that will result from the actions of that guy and all the other jerks out there. The choice is mine. Furthermore, as we gradually loosen the solidity of our sense of self with its elaborate defensive structures and truly open to the reality as before us, we had better be prepared to be affected by the world. If we are intimate with the world, then when we are confronted by the suffering of others, we will feel that suffering. When we see the growing destruction of the natural world, we will feel it as keenly as if our own body was being destroyed, which it is. Zen calls upon us to be engaged in life. We cannot remain detached in the bubble of our own personal nirvana, although we certainly get glimpses of that other absolute perspective. And as we feel the pain of the world, we are compelled to act as our natural compassion is drawn forth. This is essential. Zen is a Mahayana practice which emphasizes the way of the Bodhisattva whose life and practice are for the sake of the world and all beings. As we say when we chant the four Bodhisattva vow, creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Finally, we come to enlightenment. After all, isn't this what all Buddhist practice aims for? frankly, in my view, enlightenment is a term whose meaning has been so distorted by popular conceptualizations that it's lost any relevance. It has acquired an almost supernatural connotation in our American imagination. In Zen, we feel that the process of our practice does not transform us into anyone special. In fact, we say that it does not transform us at all, because we already have Buddha nature. We simply need to awaken to that reality. Ultimately, our practice helps our fundamental ordinariness shine through, as our need to maintain a self-image through postures and pretenses diminishes. In Zen, instead of talking about enlightenment, we speak of awakening and realizing the one body. We feel it as essential to recognize that all things are deeply, intimately connected, that this entire universe is truly one body. We must come to see that each and every thing in this universe affects that entire body. Each thought, each action, each life is therefore supremely important. We begin to truly see that we need to be responsible for every aspect of our lives. Therefore, in Zen, we shift from talking about what Buddhism can do for me, which I feel we can be led to by the current understanding of the terms mindfulness, equanimity, and enlightenment, to what Buddhism can do for the world. There's a wonderful little practice that can remind us of this. Every time we bow before we sit down on the cushions, we can pause and give away any merit that might be attained by that sitting to those who suffer more than we do. Repeatedly recognizing this, we can very, very gradually turn from a life that's dedicated to maintaining and decorating the cage of our own ego to one that is lived for the healing of this world. That is the path of Zen. Finally, we should recognize that the Dharma is dynamic and ever-changing. In each time and place, teaching is done with expedient means. Shakyamuni chose his words teaching Hindus in India 2,500 years ago. Thus, while his teaching is timeless, the words may need to change from time to time to keep the meaning fresh and relevant. Who knows how the expression of this wonderful Dharma will change as it evolves and grows here in the West over the next 1,000 years. So please feel free, whatever anyone might want to question on that or add to it.
Peter, you have a wonderful ability to simplify important things to, I'm not quite sure how to say it, but it clarifies and brings it right back to right now in our lives. That's truly appreciated. I was reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is all about mindfulness. I mean, that does seem to be a holy thing to them, and an awful lot of emotion, examining emotion, and it really made me feel uncomfortable. Partly because I'm not a very emotive person, but it somehow didn't seem to be balanced. Now that may be because it's only one of hundreds of books that he's written, but that particular emphasis didn't feel right to me.
So, what might the guy have said, aside from your Dharma talk? No, there's the background is the chaplains are retiring at Colby, and it's been just ridiculously inadequate. And so I called up the dean and I said, I want you to get an interfaith minister, and I want to be on the committee. And I said I was very happy to see that the person who leads the outdoor orientation trips or freshmen is interested in mindfulness. And that we could use some mindfulness on the campus. So then Peter said, well, I'm going to be destroying mindfulness. So we're as always, we're stuck in the spot where all terms are inadequate, or R.P. Blackmore once said a beautiful thing. He says, the tragedy of thought is that it takes a mold too soon and suffers a fate like infant damnation. So any term that we put up there is going to be somebody's, not their beacon, but something they jump into to avoid thinking. So what do we do?
I mean, I think it's a good question. I mean, we're sort of perpetually hung by the tongue. But that's the word that's out there, you know, so we have to kind of use it to a certain extent, I think, you know, just like this week, you know, my supervisor said to me he would like to have, you know, mindfulness meditation for the agency, and would I be willing to lead mindfulness, you know, and he'd watched the Dharma Brothers, and he wants to have, is that what it's called, about the inmates in
Oh, the Dharma Brothers, yeah.
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 And it wants to have mindfulness now for the inmates in the jail and so on and so forth. And to some extent, one of the expedient things about that word is it's sort of sanitized of the Buddhism, you know, so it you can say we're going to, you know, in a secular government-funded agency that we're going to do mindfulness and no one's going to, you know, run and file a suit, you know, or that we're going to bring it into the jail and that we're not proselytizing for Buddhism. So it also has its sort of expediency in a different way.
You know, there is something about using the word mindfulness with gentleness and on the same sort of realm. And, I mean, that's what I loved about your talk. Like, Deborah, I felt like it was very present, but it's also so gentle and so such a clear and kind way of talking about what this monk was saying without being like, oh, you know, he was wrong and we have it right here. And you know, and I think that there's a lot of that in the world where mindfulness is a weapon instead of being you know, it's thrown out to make people feel badly about who they are and about how crazy our minds are. And, you know, I don't know anybody who can count to 10. And I also live, you know, in Maine, but that's not a bad thing. And that's not bad to be able to say, I'm still trying, and mindfulness is a part of my daily practice, but I don't have to judge myself on that, or hang myself for that matter.
Really good point. I mean, thinking when you said that, anything can, you know, be used that way. You know, people use vegetarian the same way.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's one thing just to be a vegetarian because you don't want to eat meat for whatever reason. But then it's another thing to be a vegetarian because you're not one of those carnivores, you know. like one of the teachers who I won't mention. Who enjoys bacon, my God. So you're right. The words can be used in a way that's... can be destructive. You know, one of the challenges I think that I've set for myself, and I appreciate what both you and Deborah said, but, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I was doing this interfaith panel at the high school, I was thinking, I need to be able to explain the Dharma in a way that the high school kids can understand it. And if I can't do that, then I really can't explain the Dharma, you know. And I don't see myself as there, but I see that myself as a journey that I'd like to be on. The teacher I think that I admire most in that regard is Bankei. He could explain the Dharma to anybody. It was not fancy. It was not, you know. And I think that's at least one of our challenges is, you know, demystifying the language, making it accessible so that we could explain it to high school kids or whoever.
And I find it surprising that we need to keep saying it over and over again. It's like, today this is clear, and But the same thing needs to be said 2 months from now to remind me that I'm getting caught up in words again, or getting caught up in something again. I keep needing to be refreshed, which is possibly why I keep coming back.
You can make it 2 months without needing to be refreshed.
No. I just kind of grabbed that.
Right at the risk of throwing something out, being the new person, but my father and I have always talked about using music as a metaphor. Music as a metaphor, and how, you know, when you start to play, there is a need to learn, like, scales and structure and something about theory, but the danger is in thinking that that's the music. And he said, you know, and the goal is at some point you can integrate that and then let it all go, and then the music really, that you're making, is really coming from a genuine place. And I think it's, you know, in my own life, it's comfortable to grab onto a tool and see it as an end instead of a means. Mm-hmm. It feels, you know, it's something stable to grasp onto. And, you know, I need that reminder that, you know, even the tool can become an obstacle if it's seen in that way.
Well, I think that's the genius of Zen, actually, is to keep knocking the props out from under everybody.
It's kind of stupid genius, but it's hate everything.
To me, Buddhism is just living my life. I'm not trying to be mindful. I'm not trying to be this or that. I'm just living my life, and that's all it is. And I never even knew what equanimity was. Like, I never knew that word, what it was. So.
When you are in the state of equanimity, you are equanimous. And there's a word I love.
It means you're a cousin to a horse. I never heard that word.
It's funny, in world literature, there's very few people with equanimity. Mm-hmm. You can come through American literature and find just very few instances of complete equanimity. The only one that comes to my mind right now is Queequeg and Moby Dick. He's not upset. And it's clear that he has some other source of knowledge than everybody else. That he goes down into his meditative state.
Well, you know, Peter, you had an image that stayed with me because it's so true. You had the image of the cage of the self, the cage of the ego. And it is this cage, and it's like you were saying, it's wrought iron, and I imagine that I've spent a lot of time making sure that everything looks just right, and that it's just tight enough, and that I can sit there and stare at myself and spend some quality time agonizing. And I think that that's interesting, and it makes really good literature. And being able to say, oh, that cage, here's the door, I can open it, that's incredibly brave, and that's like what we all say we want, but it doesn't really, it takes so much, and it doesn't take anything, but it also seems like it takes so much. So it's this very, it's a very interesting state.
That's an old image. I think it goes back to the time of the Buddha. It comes from, I saw it in Trungpa Rinpoche, but I think it goes back, which was the image of a monkey in the cage, and the monkey fights and rattles the bars, and, you know, and but the monkey has to realize eventually was that the cage is never even there, you know. Mm-hmm. Kind of,
when I was working with prisoners, there was one inmate who I heard him say about someone else, you know, I think he needs to be taken out. Maybe I'll do that. He was living his life, Kyle.
He's to be taken out?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That means kill him.
Oh.
He was living his life. I think there's more to just living your life. Why are you doing the precepts? I think what you say is right, and I agree with you, but our lives need to be informed. And you're informing your life. Don't deny what's informing you. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So it's, when you say it's just living my life, there's more to it than that. It's living my life in a way which does honor to my life and honor to others. No? Without trying to do it, though.
Yeah.
No? But as soon as you try to do it, you kill it. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I have a hard time with people running away from the term Buddhism. I mean, when we worked in the prison, we were overtly Buddhist. We went in there as Buddhists. We did Buddhist service. We did Buddhist chants, we talked about Shakyamuni Buddha. I mean, Steph read the Jataka tales and we talked about those. And in so many ways, unless there is a structure, you come to a point where there's no content. Yeah, I guess that's... In our structure, the structure that we have here is a Buddhist structure. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing wrong with, if somebody asks you what your religion is, saying I'm a Buddhist or I'm a Christian or I'm a Christo-Buddhist or a Buddha-Christian, whatever you want to say. But and there's nothing wrong with owning what informs us. You don't have to proselytize, but I do think we need to own it.
But if it's a question of, this was a prison in Alabama, where everybody's a fundamentalist, so they go in, or they don't go in, they're not going in and saying they're Buddhists, they won't get in. The guy who's running the prison says, I'm not letting any Buddhists in here, but I'll let this guy come in, and because it seems like it might do some good.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's upaya, skillful means. I mean, you don't have to write it on your forehead.
I do.
But I agree with what you're saying, Margaret. Moreover, I think many people are taking the structure out of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Buddhism is a bunch of us just hanging around on Saturday morning, you know, and then as opposed to systematic way in which the props are knocked out, in which the,
And also there's a huge body of teaching that is extraordinarily valuable, and I would encourage all of you to read the sutras.
Well, if you stay here, you will.
By perforce.
It's funny, the Milarepa, Tibetan saint. I read a bunch of chapters in there, and he's an amazing fountain of the Dharma. Yeah, but I got tired of him because he's just too amazing.
Just what?
It's just too amazing. It's it's just endless, perfection. Yeah. And so I asked Losang about Nagarjuna, and he said, about Milarepa, and he said, oh, when he was a little boy, in this school, removed from his parents and everything else, he read Milarepa, and that's what allowed him to live the rest of his life, because his father was dead. He felt very much in the same position as him, and that's when he decided he was going to become a monk. So I'm sitting here reading it, and his whole life was enabled by that this guy's figure.
Well, we never know what will touch us or people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free him. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
I need Deborah and Peter Harris to come.